It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Life Sciences Research in Pittsburgh is getting a $1 billion infusion over the next 4 years. UPMC Enterprises, the commercialization arm of the local hospital and health plan giant, says it will invest that amount to help develop new drugs, diagnostic tools, and other medical devices. Jean Cunicelli is the executive vice president for UPMC Enterprises. She spoke in Bakery Square recently to the Confluence's Megan Harris.
People in Pittsburgh at least know UPMC for a couple of things, hospitals and insurance, but Enterprises has been around quietly funding software and some medical devices for years now. Why the big push now? Why $1 billion all at once?
So I think it's worth discussing the nature of UPMC, the very same people who decided that investing $800 million into the technologies you described are the very same people who also know that unless we change medicine for patients and change it in a very bold way, perhaps the course of treatment for many patients isn't good. So about 3 years ago, UPMC launched what's called the ITTC, which is the Immune Transplant and Therapy Center, with an initial $200 million investment. They asked me to help them. I was helping them from afar, as I realized that this was going to be quite a large initiative. I decided to move here and devote my time to this, my professional time to this. From that period, that was January 2017, the goal has always been that that was a foundation from which we can build great investments in areas that complement the technologies and devices. So that would be drugs and diagnostics and devices that complement, as I said, with the goal of pushing the frontiers of science, pushing what it means to really care for patients, how to make sure that UPMC is at the center of that. There's so much innovation between UPMC and the University of Pittsburgh. So when we started this, one of the brilliant tenets of it was that, in fact, we're sitting right next to one of the top five NIH-funded universities in the country. And very quietly, that university was recruiting world leaders in areas of ophthalmology and aging, immunology, all of the areas that should make a backbone for how you think about the future of science and medicine. So when you put those two together, you know, the starter kit's here, and now it takes bold thinking. And so it wasn't an all of a sudden thing, but in a way it was, because it's only 3 years in, but we need to be this bold.
Remind us, for folks who aren't as familiar with Enterprises, this third arm of UPMC, the parent company, what exactly does Enterprises do, and how is the public, as you imagine it, going to engage with that side of the company?
Oh, sure. Great. So if you think about it, there's something called venture capital. So it's been really the titular sort of venture capitalist on behalf of UPMC. And what that means is you put money to work in exciting new technologies, hoping to change an industry and then generate some sort of benefit to the system, financial or otherwise. On the technology side, that has been going on for, I think, 11 years. And in fact, there have been both financial and system-wide benefits from the work done here. That could include engineering. That can include support for what goes on in the payer part of it. So add in now my group, which is now the Translational Sciences, which is the home of the billion-dollar investment, and what you have is medicines, therapeutics. How we interact with the public on several fronts. Number one, I have this belief that it is our obligation, in fact, to make sure we know this community. This is a very, very special place with special thinkers, and you and I were talking earlier about how special those thinkers are. They're forward-thinking people. They're people from all walks of life. There's the mix of UPMC, and there's the mix of Carnegie Mellon, and the mix of Pitt. So that's one way to interact with the public, right? Just generally in the halls. The other way is people who have ideas should come and introduce themselves to us at any event, over the email, over the phone, however they like to get in touch with us, and talk to us about those ideas. Because even if we don't invest in your idea today, getting to know us and thinking through how we might pivot your idea, or that may be something you want to hear and something you might want to hear, but just starting that dialogue. So we could be good corporate citizens. We could be good community citizens. We can be people who, and should be people who, take the ideas that are circulating around Pittsburgh and beyond and moving them through the UPMC system and figuring out, as I said, what makes a good investment and what's truly going to change the practice of medicine in a positive way.
Enterprises historically, it seems like, has done a lot to help some of the companies that it's been investing in, sometimes, you know, through their communications and marketing work, helping them tell their stories, or just straight up funding. How do you imagine the investment strategy is going to work for this new batch of money? Are you going to be looking for early phase investments, for short term offerings? What's the investment strategy?
Mixed. We call it stage agnostic. But whether we invest at the earliest stage or the latest stage, they'll still have those benefits of enterprises, marketing, you know, company building, all of that, anything a company needs. So it would be anything from the smallest investment could be a couple hundred thousand all the way through to a much larger investment that could be in the tens of millions.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris in Bakery Square talking to Gene Cunicelli of UPMC Enterprises. Gene, you came to Pittsburgh from a life sciences investment firm in San Francisco. $1 billion in Pittsburgh sounds pretty big, but in the wider world of biotech investing, is it that big?
Yeah, it's $1 billion. And when you think about that, there's lots of capital out there right now that are larger size funds, as we call it. So I could name three off the top of my head that are $600 or $800 million. This matches that, and the point is that not only is it impactful for Pittsburgh, I'd say any company out there that's looking for financing would be comforted knowing that with the size investment that UPMC is making, we can support that company all the way through its life cycle. So it's not just Pittsburgh where it's big. It raises eyebrows everywhere.
What kinds of companies do you imagine putting money into? Are they going to be in Pittsburgh or elsewhere?
Both. The goal would be that whichever company we invest in has a tie, whether that's through clinical knowledge. We have so much to offer these companies from, you know, the UPMC perspective. We're a payer, we're a provider, we're an integrated delivery system. But not all could be in Pittsburgh. Some may need to be in other cities.
And you mentioned before drugs are and pharmaceuticals are part of this investment strategy. How is that different from what Enterprises has been doing before? Drugs are brand new, right?
For Enterprises, for the most part, yes. That's very new. They did not have the depth of knowledge. They knew how to. Enterprises was very thoughtful. They built where their skill set, you know, reflective of their skill set. And when they brought me in, I have that background in investing in therapeutics and diagnostics. And we have built a team of 20 MDs, PhD, people who live the care of patients and how to study what makes sense. So yes, it now reflects a competency of Enterprises.
How risky do you think that you're going to be with Enterprises' portfolio?
What a great question. It's in the vein of the way UPMC thinks generally, and the answer is we have a risk tolerance that's pretty high. You have to be in this business. If you think about it, something that's in phase one, you have a 1 in 10 chance of actually making it to fruition as an approved product. So when you have that kind of risk profile that could take you $100 million before you know if you have a risk, if you have a product, you have to have a pretty big stomach for risk. On the other hand, done well, that risk pays off tenfold. Not again, financially as well as for the patient.
When the announcement was made, UPMC self-reported that its previous investments of $800 million have yielded about $1.5 billion. So $800 in and $700 in revenue back out. That's not a bad return. Do you imagine that this new capital is going to be flowing faster since it's a four-year timeline?
Yeah, it needs to. It needs to. It needs to have just as big, if not bigger, an impact financially, the numbers that you just described. So I would expect, look, we have got to get the money in the ground over the next 3 to 4 years, and we should be seeing some returns of some earlier investments in that time period.
So how do you do that? How do you replicate that success or make it, you know, wildly better?
It's my job, but, and I say that with tongue in cheek, because after 20 years of this type of investing, you've seen so many deals, you know what makes sense. You know what the market needs. You understand what clinicians think would make patient outcomes improve. Then there's the added element of who, what leaders can you pick that can drive your investment to the kind of returns we're discussing. There's so many elements, but at the same time, it's very obvious. Sometimes you just know this isn't going to fly. And sometimes you just know you can't back a certain entrepreneur. So I hate to say it, but you know what, when you see it, after a lot of diligence, it's still sometimes a combination of a lot of quantitative work with a lot of soul searching in terms of your knowledge of what might make a good investment.
So tell us about that shop. Who are the team of people that'll be making the decisions about how this money is spent?
Sure. So in addition to myself, I have 5 senior leaders. We meet every Friday for at least 3 or 4 hours. We discuss. It's a pretty close team. And there's some heated discussions about how to invest this money, which you would expect. We take great pride, and in fact, we are the stewards of this, and we understand the responsibility.
What is it like in the war room then? Yeah. So are you, you know, sitting around bouncing off ideas? Do you have to present research on the spot? Do you come with a brand new company that maybe no one's even heard of before?
So first of all, everything's a process. A company comes in the door, we assign a team, and within 2 weeks, we like to get back to people as to whether or not we're going to take a deeper look. That deeper look usually means a meeting where anybody from the team, any of the 20, is invited. In fact, I like when most people come. Then you say, okay, that went well. Let's go into diligence. You identify what are the key questions that would make or break your decision. And then there's a partner champion of that group I discussed. So nothing's a surprise, and you communicate all through the process how diligence is going. The beauty of this is that no deal is perfect. No investment on the way in the door is perfect. The trick is that you know where the challenging spots are so that by the time you've made the money, nothing's a surprise, right? The war room is a decision about how much, you know, if we have three deals, we always have to stay disciplined about how many. We can't do too many at once. If we have three in front of us, how do you prioritize? And because we've done such good diligence, guess what? You could make the case for any of them. So as a group, how to decide which of those to take forward is really where the final, you know, decision, as you call it, the war room, is made. But this is a multi-month process, but the process works.
So for now, are the companies coming to you, or are you reaching out trying to find innovation where it lies?
Both, and we will never stop doing both. So we make an effort now to do conferences, select conferences that are not necessarily in Pittsburgh, or we make a very big effort to do conferences and outreach here. And now our job, it's one thing to say you have the money to invest, but we are outreaching on both coasts and in biotech hubs all over the country and in other innovation hubs all over the country. It's got to be best in class. And if that best in class is here in Pittsburgh, great. If that best in class is somewhere else, then that's where we will make the investment.
On the flip side, do you think that $1 billion is enough? Are you looking even further into the future?
Actually, that's a great question. Success would mean that $1 billion is not enough, right? I think it's enough for right now. You know, the discipline with which you have to deploy this capital cannot be understated. So it sounds great, but you have to be as careful as you were with the first 200, yet have an even bigger impact. So it's a great question, and if we're asking for more in a couple of years, it's because we were successful.
So short term, where do you imagine your greatest pocket of success might be? Is it going to be through medications, devices, software? What do you expect?
I think we have great investments in the area, and I'd call it therapeutic areas. We're sort of agnostic of what we really look at is what's the right modality. Is it a drug? Is it a device? Is it a diagnostic? We are highly focused in the area of solid cancer tumors, and that could be anything from, you know, a small molecule to a cell therapy. We're highly focused in what we call healthy aging, and that could span chronic diseases, which are typically therapeutic interventions. Things like ophthalmology is a lot of combination of drugs and devices, so it depends on the end area.
So your prognosis for the next few weeks, how will you be staying busy?
It's more like, how do I stay organized? I'd say a third of my time is spent with my leadership team. And then another third of my time is looking at what we call internal opportunities through Pitt, through the UPMC folks. And then a third of my time is talking to my likeness around the country. So because the announcement was so recent, I've got all kinds of calls and meetings with other venture capitalists so we can share ideas about deals we may want to invest in together.
What's the most exciting part of this process to you?
The investment process?
Just the fact that it's finally out there, it's public, it's getting going, and you get to start.
I cannot wait to get started. To me, there is so much to do and so much exciting work out there, and meeting the right people, that has always for me been the most exciting part of it, and learning how, it's amazing what the human brain continues to do and continues to push the frontiers of science in ways that seemed science fiction 10 years ago, but are genuinely real today. And so, wow, have at it. If our goal is to change the practice of medicine and improve patient outcomes and do it in a bold way, open up the floodgates in terms of all these great thinkers out there. So meeting as many of them as we can and working with them as closely as they'll allow us to work with them.
Jean Cunicelli is the Executive Vice President for UPMC Enterprises. Jean, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Nice chatting with you today.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. 4 years after a mass shooting in a backyard in Wilkinsburg, the trial for the two men accused begins today. Then, will a new partial trade deal between D.C. and Beijing help the 135,000 lost jobs in Pennsylvania over the last 20 years? You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the city's first female solicitor and state's first female attorney general, Anne X. Alpern, passes away in 1981. Alpern was born in Russia and moved to Washington County when she was a child. She earned her bachelor's and a law degree from the University of Pittsburgh. After working for the city on its backlog of cases, Alpern was appointed to the solicitor position full-time by then-Mayor Cornelius Scully. In addition to her later work as state attorney general, she was also appointed to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. After her death, the State Bar Association established an award in her honor for women who demonstrate excellence in the legal profession. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania has removed more than 300 small dams that cross waterways, making it a leader in the nation. As the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports, an effort to remove some of the thousands of unused dams in the Ohio River watershed will improve safety and fish habitat, but not everyone is ready for it.
Growing up in the small riverfront village of Lowellville, Ohio, by the Pennsylvania border, Jim Udiciani stayed away from the Mahoning River.
When I was a kid, if I went near that river, we'd get smacked because it was so dirty and dangerous.
Now, as mayor of Lowellville, he's been pushing for years to get rid of the old steel industry dam that crosses the river here. And he says it's coming down this summer.
On the joking side, they call me the dam mayor, and for good reason, finally.
Just steps from the village downtown, Udiciani stands alongside the river where brush has been cleared for heavy equipment needed to remove the dam, a series of 8 low concrete piers that point downstream. It will be the first in a regional plan to remove 9 dams along the Mahoning River, which crosses into Pennsylvania and joins the Shenango to form the Beaver River. Right now, people who canoe and kayak on the Mahoning need to pull their boats out of the water and carry them around the dam.
Where you see all the whiteness underneath, that's just the hydraulics, which makes it very dangerous.
Ohio regulators describe these low-head dams as drowning machines because canoes and other boats can get trapped in the recirculating current below the dam. Once the Lowellville Dam is removed, Udiciani wants his riverfront village to become a hotspot for outdoor recreation. He points out where a new park with space for canoes is planned. He talks about a new restaurant,
bicycle shop, kayak rental,
the yoga studio, and new living space.
We're looking at 4 or 5-story buildings being built on the river, possibly B&Bs and or condos with multi-use parking underneath. Yeah, this whole thing is going to be a catalyst for us for development.
It's a far cry from the region's steelmaking days, but even after most steel mills closed, an Ohio EPA survey still found the effects of pollution in the river.
They found fish with lesions and tumors on them. The macroinvertebrate community was poor.
That's Stephanie Dyer, Environmental Program Manager for the Eastgate Regional Council of Governments, the agency leading the Mahoning Dam Removal Project. In the late 1990s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers looked into dredging the river to get rid of contaminants, especially behind the low-head dams. But the Corps never moved forward with its river cleanup. Then in the early 2000s, an Ohio grant program assisted with dam removals on the nearby Cuyahoga River.
And that's when it started to click here at Eastgate, as well as within the region, that we can do this on our own as a local community and as a region.
According to Eastgate, Lowellville and the cities of Struthers and Youngstown have secured more than $10 million to remove 5 dams with funding from the Ohio EPA and a settlement with LTV Corporation.
This river built the valley, and so now it's time we all realized, which we're doing, is giving back to the river and creating the free-flowing state it should be in right now.
But some communities don't want their dams taken down.
You know what? We just want to be left alone.
Edward Anthony is a trustee for Warren Township, a rural area 20 miles upriver from Lowellville and home of the Levittsburg Dam. Local fire officials here say if their dam is removed, they won't have the pool of water it creates as a secondary source for emergencies. And health officials worry that without the dam, water levels will be too low to dilute sewage from home septic systems.
So it's a grave concern because I think if they proceed with this, they're going to do this and then we're going to be left with a mess.
Looking down on the Mahoning at water flowing over the Leavittsburg Dam, resident Mike Arnold points across the river at what used to be an Ohio Edison facility.
That's where the power plant set.
The concrete dam was built to pool water for the plant, but the electric company no longer uses it.
Directly behind that dam is 12 feet.
That's Russell St. Clair, who lives along the river, which is almost like a lake behind the dam.
Just about maybe 400 yards up the river, it goes to 8 foot. Then it goes to 7 foot, like behind our house.
St. Clair and his neighbors float on pontoon boats and report seeing bald eagles and river otters. His kids and grandkids fish for muskie and perch.
The river now is better than it's ever been. I mean, it is.
Mike Arnold worries how the dam removal will affect fishing here.
There's nothing for them to eat. The fish will be gone. They can't survive in that kind of water.
But an Ohio EPA study in 2006 found that fish communities behind the dam in Leavittsburg and elsewhere along the Mahoning were impaired. And according to Eastgate, it's not yet known how the dam removal will change water levels. Ben Lorson wants to calm people's fears. After dams are removed, the same amount of water will still run down the river.
And that's not going anywhere. That'll always be there.
Lorson is a fish passage biologist with the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission. He says removing dams is better for fish.
There's kind of this misconception that, you know, you're taking a good fishing spot away, when in reality, those fish want to go upstream. They're just not able to because the dam's in their way.
Oftentimes when it comes to aquatic organism passage, we like to say, if you unbuild it, they will come.
Jessica Collier is a fish biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She says one fish in particular that could return to the Ohio by removing dams in the watershed is the lake sturgeon. These behemoth ancient fish can live up to 150 years. They migrate long distances, sometimes hundreds of miles, to spawn. The sturgeon is considered endangered in most states throughout its range. They were overfished, their habitat was destroyed, and their migration paths were blocked by dams. Collier points to the success of a large dam removal project in the Sandusky River that flows into Lake Erie.
Within a couple months of dam removal, there was a sturgeon that migrated up the river, and it was the first time a sturgeon had been seen in that river system in maybe a century.
And in the Ohio, removing dams is bringing back people too, according to federal fish biologist Donovan Henry, who coordinates the Ohio River Basin Fish Habitat Partnership.
And pretty soon you have people kayaking and paddling and canoeing on these rivers as people are using the river or making stops along the way to dine and shop. So the community and the river start tying together, and it does promote economic vitality.
Standing on the banks of the Mahoning, Lowellville Mayor Jim Udiciani wants that future for his village. But looking at the river roll over the dam today, he still sees beauty in it.
Getting this surreal feeling, a sad feeling too, that now it's coming out, we're never going to see this again either. But it needs done, you know.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
That story is part of Good River, stories about the environment, economy, and culture of the Ohio River. More at ohiowatershed.org. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On March 9th, 2016, five people, including a woman who was 8 months pregnant, were shot and killed during a cookout at a home in Wilkinsburg. Now, nearly 4 years later, opening arguments are to be presented today in the trial of Sharon Shelton of Lincoln Lemington and Robert Thomas of Wilkinsburg, each charged with 5 counts of homicide and 1 count of homicide of an unborn child. Pittsburgh Tribune reviewer Megan Guza has been covering this case all along, and we spoke this morning right before court began for the day. Megan, briefly remind us, that night it was unseasonably warm, a backyard cookout.
So this family, one of the victims, Brittany Powell, was living at this home in Wilkinsburg, decided to have a get-together, have a cookout, 12 to 15 people, including a bunch of her family members, gathered here, and it was about 10:53, 54 that night that the shooting started.
What did the prosecutors say happened with two? They weren't
side by side or anything like that, correct?
Right. What investigators say happened is, in their version of events, that Robert Thomas came from kind of adjacent to the backyard, the little alley that runs next to it, started shooting with a handgun. All of these partygoers start fleeing toward the back door of the house. And Sharon Shelton was allegedly right there with an AK-47 style rifle and started shooting at the kind of bottleneck that formed right there at the back door.
What are prosecutors saying the motive was?
Vengeance. They're saying the motive was vengeance on the part of Sharon Shelton. He was seeking revenge on one specific person, Lamont Powell, who is a sibling of three of the individuals who were killed. He was shot and injured, shot three times, I believe, but recovered. And Sharon Shelton allegedly just wanted to, you know, take out him and as many people in his sphere as he could.
So the two were charged within a few months. So give us a sense why it's taken, you know, seemingly such a long time to come to trial.
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the death penalty is on the table for both of these men if they are convicted. There's a lot that goes in behind that, and there are four defense attorneys involved in this, two for each of the men, and two prosecutors involved, and that many people, you know, filing motions. That takes time, and reviewing them takes time, and it takes time to prepare for a capital case.
I mentioned opening arguments for the two suspects, but there's a chance charges could be dismissed against one of them, Robert Thomas, and we should find out this morning. Why might those charges be dismissed?
So the prosecutors have decided to not call their main, possibly their only witness against Robert Thomas, a jailhouse witness, paid informant. And without that witness's testimony, Thomas's attorneys argue there's really no tangible evidence. It's all circumstantial. There's nothing that places him at the scene other than cell phone data, and you know that's not exact. So they are moving to have all of the charges dismissed against him because of lack of evidence.
Jury selection itself took 3 weeks. Why so long for that?
The interview, the questioning process for prospective jurors in a capital case is long, for a lack of better phrasing. The potential jurors who came in and weren't automatically dismissed because of, you know, work obligations, those who, you know, made it through the first couple questions, defense attorneys questioned them for 45 minutes to an hour, each of them. And even after going through all of that, the defense attorneys still could strike a juror, or the prosecutors could. So could maybe get through 10 jurors a day questioning, and whether any of those would be chosen was up in the air.
Weren't a couple who were accepted then decided to be removed?
Yes. There were three altogether, I believe, who had been selected and were then dismissed before jury selection was even completed. I believe one, extenuating job circumstances, for a variety of reasons. But the judge did agree to let them out of jury service, and the latest one being Thursday, I think. So we're down to 17, 12, and 5 alternatives.
You report about 12 to 15 people were at the cookout. What have you heard about the survivors testifying?
I do know they intend to call all three that were injured, including John Ellis, who was critically wounded and remains paralyzed. Lamont Powell, the intended target, he's been held in the Allegheny jail for the past week or so on a material witness warrant to make sure that he will appear in court and testify as they want him to. So I know they intend to call those closest to the shooting very early in the trial.
At the time, District Attorney Steven Cipolla called it the worst he's seen. Do you get a sense of how closely the Wilkinsburg community is watching? Are the families saying anything?
The families, they have not been able to say anything because they are covered by a gag order that was signed into effect in July 2017. So yeah, they've been covered by that. They are unable to speak publicly.
So that covers the attorneys, witnesses, and family members.
Attorneys, witnesses, family members, anyone who could possibly be involved with the trial itself.
The trial, how long is it expected to last?
10 to 15 business days is what the judge has been saying. I get the distinct feeling that we'll be much closer to 15 than 10.
And if convicted, what could happen to the suspect or suspects?
They face either the jury will deliberate on either life in prison without the possibility of parole or the death penalty.
Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporter Megan Guza, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In January, President Trump announced a partial trade deal with China to reduce tariffs. But will that help restore some of the estimated 135,000 jobs Pennsylvania has lost since 2001 due to the trade deficit with China? Economist Stephen Herzenberg is the executive director of the Keystone Research Center, whose partner, the Economic Policy Institute, released a jobs impact study on Thursday. He joins us on the line now from Harrisburg. Stephen, thanks for taking the time.
Great to be here.
Stephen, whether it's the tens of thousands of jobs evaporating in Pennsylvania or the projected 3.7 million across the country, how can we know that this is directly a result of the trade deficit with China?
This study is very straightforward data, real data on whether the Trump trade policy is working, measured by the trade balance and the number of jobs supported by exports and lost because of imports. And the answer is it's not working. I mean, the methodology is basically to look at precisely how many U.S. jobs are supported by our exports to China, and then look at how many jobs are displaced because of our imports from China. Mm-hmm. It's the simplest possible methodology, and that's what gets you the 137,000 jobs lost in Pennsylvania since China entered the World Trade Organization and the 3.7 million lost in the U.S. as a whole.
Specifically in Pennsylvania, what parts of the state have seen the biggest losses?
The EPI report breaks down the losses by each congressional district, and there are about four or five districts where you've seen over 9,000 jobs lost. Two of those are in the northwest corner of the state, which is historically a very strong manufacturing region, including General Electric. A couple of them, interestingly, are in the suburban districts of Philadelphia, where nowadays you have a pretty diversified and sophisticated manufacturing sector, certainly including pharmaceuticals and chemicals. And then the fifth district is up in the northeast corner of the state. Mm-hmm.
The study focused about two decades, covering three presidential administrations. Has the impact evolved on various industry sectors, say in Pennsylvania, over the last two decades, maybe hitting one industry harder in the first part in the first decade and another in more recent years?
Obviously, at particular points in time, there may be different dynamics in a single industry. For example, the global steel industry went through a downward price spiral and a great deal of job loss in the late 1990s and early 2000s. But by and large, the overall trends in Pennsylvania have been that the broad manufacturing sector continues to take a hit because of our unbalanced trade, especially with China. I mean, the real problem is that our basic issue on trade policy is, do you approach trade with the goal of benefiting working people and each trading partner, or with the goal of giving international corporations the rules and the investment and intellectual property protections they want? We've negotiated for decades to benefit multinational corporations and ignoring regular workers, and the Trump administration hasn't broken with that.
The report by your partner indicated manufacturing sector was the hardest hit by the trade deficit across the country and in Pennsylvania. Under this new trade deal, China agreed to spend $75 billion on manufactured goods from the U.S. Do you believe this will restore some of those lost jobs here in Pennsylvania?
I certainly hope so. The proof will be in the pudding. As the EPI numbers make clear, the pudding so far is indicates that the approach of the administration is not working. And I guess I would also go back to my last answer, which is the basic approach of the Trump administration is not broad enough. It's not a reversal of the historic emphasis in U.S. trade policy on the priorities of multinational corporations, and it's not a full enough shift to focusing on what kind of trade would benefit regular workers.
Just a couple minutes left. With the coronavirus outbreak raging in mainland China, in the short term, do you see any probability of a rebound of jobs in the United States?
I don't think you're going to see a benefit because, let's say, production that was going to go on in China will now come back to the U.S., not in the short run. The challenge is that a lot of our supply chains, whether it's John Deere tractors or the iPhone, combine U.S. and Chinese and other countries' production. So the coronavirus, if it has a big impact on China, it's probably going to have a negative impact on global growth and on U.S. growth, not a positive impact in the short run.
So it wouldn't necessarily or won't help the U.S.?
Not in the short run.
Okay.
I mean, I think in the very long run, the coronavirus is one more factor that suggests we might want to reevaluate our dependence on China. You know, companies now know that if you have long distance sourcing and your production is separate from your research, that can make it hard to innovate. And in terms of global climate change and the energy and carbon emissions from long distance transportation, that's another reason to bring production back home from Asia in the long run. So the coronavirus might reinforce some of that long-term thinking, but that's going to take a while to unfold.
So 20 seconds. So this could affect how the U.S. conducts business with China, sort of that broader issue?
Again, in the long run, sure, this is one more reason to question how much we of our manufactured goods we get from China. Another reason is the autocratic turn recently of the Chinese government. So there's a bunch of downsides from our reliance on China. Long, long run, if we bring some of that production back home, it could strengthen our economy.
Economist Stephen Herzenberg is the executive director of the Keystone Research Center. Stephen, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. This program reminder, WESA will provide NPR special coverage of the impeachment trial of President Trump beginning at 11 this morning. Closing arguments will be presented, and a vote by the full Senate is scheduled by Wednesday. If you missed anything from today's program, you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.